Welcome to another edition of the Sea Control Podcast, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. I am, as always, Matthew Hipple, your host and president here at SimSec, and today's discussion involves an area of unmanned and autonomous technology we don't often discuss. We've discussed aerial drones, UAVs, submarine drones, UUVs, and these get a lot of attention in the press, but surprisingly enough, we don't hear a lot about unmanned surface vehicles, or essentially unmanned boats. Well, the Office of Naval Research conducted a major test of an autonomous USV on the James River last year, using a series of remote and autonomous surface vehicles to defend a high-value unit passing down the river. Tests that involve adding a system to boats already in the inventory of the United States Navy and found on most ships. Captain Carl Conti joins us today, one of the engineers and leaders involved in this test. He's going to discuss the technologies involved and how they interact, the capabilities currently demonstrated by the many systems, the future potential of this technology, and also the human element, as the personnel involved in this test, from the engineers, the scientists, to the ship operators, who are newly getting used to this idea of trusting and operating with fully autonomous systems. Captain Conti has an incredible amount of experience both in and out of the Navy developing these kinds of technologies, and we are really happy to have him. So we will be back with this podcast on autonomous surface vehicles and Captain Carl Conti after this short break.
SimSec brings you the best content on maritime security, technology, history, and international affairs. And, like the United States, SimSec is, and always will be, free. Sign up to become a member today by visiting www.cimsec.org/about/membership, which gets you daily emails of our articles and a WordPress account that sends your own writings directly to our editorial staff. However, admin, special projects, software, events, and prizes do cost money. There is a new option to make a voluntary monthly donation at the bottom of every SimSec article. No matter how you choose to support us, those who volunteer for leadership, our amazing content producers, our readers, our listeners, our conference planners and attendees, and our financial benefactors, we are incredibly grateful. Remember, Sea Control is more than just a podcast, and SimSec is more than just a website. We are a vibrant community built on a passion for discovery and discussion. Sign up, write, donate, comment, or even leave 5 stars on our iTunes page. Join us today.
And welcome back to another episode of Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. So, today we have Captain Carl Conti, a United States Navy retired, to discuss with us the Office of Naval Research autonomous drone test on the James River. Now, when a lot of people hear the word drone, I know we've got a lot of aviators and Air Force types, aviators, of course, naval aviators and Air Force types listening, and we all often assume as Americans it's flying drones. Well, in this case, we're talking about surface vessels. We're talking about boats. In particular, it's fair to call it a sort of force protection test using autonomous systems. But sir, it's a pleasure to have you. And before we get into the meat of the topic, let me just open the floor to you for a minute or two to explain who you are, where you're from, and what it is that brought you here and informs your perspective on the future and execution of this project.
Sure. Well, hey, thanks for having me. I'd say the biggest thing is I've been one of those aviators, one of those naval aviator guys you were referring to. But yeah, throughout my career, I pretty much was a carrier guy. It did all my time in A6s, F-14s, S-3s, couldn't hold a flying job. Everything kept going out from underneath me. They'd retire it. But anyway, throughout my career, seeing some of these drones and UAVs coming on the line, the folks when I was down in Pensacola were doing a lot of that work 10 years ago, more than that now, starting to fly Pioneers and things. So I saw a lot of that during my aviation time. And then after I finished the flying part, I was in the experimentation program and started running the Navy's fleet experimentation program and got involved with a bunch of different efforts, including one that had USVs, unmanned surface vessels. So as we were doing some unmanned surface vessel experimentation, I was pretty interested in it because these boats pretty much were interesting from the perspective of, hey, we made a lot of mistakes on the UAV side when we started this, and I had some perspective there. So it was, hey, how do we fix this, and how do we make sure that we don't make the same mistakes? Because you'll see when people talk about unmanned right now, and like you said, drones, lots of air vehicles, and there's a few ground vehicles out there, but very few surface vehicles. Most of this stuff is in the air. So the surface guys are a little bit behind on that part on the USV side, as opposed to the aviation side, because they've been flying them for so long. So how do we avoid making those same kind of mistakes? And when I was doing the experimentation effort, we started to look at some of these things. And then I had an opportunity once I retired to join some folks that do this. So that's what I decided to do. It's very interesting. And like I like to tell people when I give briefs about this program, we're building Skynet right now, and our job is to make sure the robots don't kill us. So
perfect. It's interesting. You mentioned the idea of all these aircraft getting retired from under you. I suppose that would explain why it is that you're kind of open to these new innovations and adaptations, because you've never been allowed to settle down in any one platform or area.
Sure.
They keep taking them from you. But
it definitely is an issue. And it's one of those things that you learn in the Navy. You see it all the time, but you learn to adapt to new environments, do different things all the time.
So, you know what? You've brought up something that I was not aware of before we started down on the path for this podcast. Before we get into the ONR test on the James River, maybe go in a little bit to the USV unmanned surface boats, surface vehicles, USV tests that you were doing before you retired, because there's got to be a small history here involved to get us to this point.
Sure. So some of the things that were out there, we did a lot of work in the IT world. When I first started experimentation, I was working at the Navy's Network Warfare Command. And then we moved that over to Fleet Forces Command, where we stood up the Fleet Experimentation Program. The stuff that we were doing there was IT-based. It was looking at how do we have – it wasn't quite AI, artificial intelligence yet, but it was more of – how do we use computers to do the control pieces, to do the sensors, and to take the burden off of the person? So that was part of it, looking at those things, looking at the sensor pieces. And then the other part of it was for the control of the vessel itself. So some of the experiments that had happened, one of them was a force protection exercise, where there were four boats that were out there doing force protection of a fixed asset. It was like a port protection type thing, and we did it up at Fort Monroe. And the idea was that the different boats would talk to each other. They each had a sector to protect, and then an intruder would come through that sector or through their sectors, and the boats would intercept, escort, and then hand off to the next one. And the final boat had it was an LRAD. It's a long-range, basically an acoustic hailing device. And it would warn them, hey, just get out of the way. You're approaching approaching naval territory. Don't go here. Turn around. So that was the kind of stuff that we did. They weren't cooperative per se. They were more just kind of the boats are working together in the fact that they knew where each other were. But we had done those experiments with them. We had also done some force protection things off of one of the LHAs over at Norfolk at the Naval Station, where the boat basically did some patrolling up and down the piers. Is again a harbor protection type of scenario where it was looking for folks, looking for bad guys that had cameras. It would go out and look and see, hey, I got a picture here, or I've got something on my sensors. I'm going to send you a picture. It's not completely, we're not going to send full motion video all the time. You know, everybody loves to have full motion video. Everybody wants to see everything all the time. And it's very taxing on IT systems to do that. And until we can invent that 10,000 mile long fiber optic cable that we can drag along behind a ship and not get tangled, we're going to have to figure out how to do that, via satellite, things like that, which is expensive. So, that's where we kind of got in. That's the IT crossover into the USV crossover. It's like, hey, how do we not have to do this control piece where we're not doing remote control? I want the boat to drive itself. I want the sensors to operate themselves. And it just kind of alerts me, hey, there's something going on. Let me send you a picture, and now you can take some action. But in the meantime, boat does everything all by itself. So that's what we were really looking at back when I was running fleet experimentation, try to see how do we offload that stuff and how do we make these things useful to help the folks not have, to not have a bunch of folks out on the water in the middle of winter, in the rain, you know, in the bad weather, in the heat, whatever it happens to be. It's a human thing. And what do we want robots to do? We want them to do the dull, dirty, dangerous work. So that was really what we were looking at back then. And that's kind of translated now. And this program has been going on since 2007. So it's really, it's got a lot of legs, and it's starting to really mature and get to where it needs to be to start being fielded.
So you've described a bit in short what it was that you did last year in August on the James River, which is you have an HVU, you have vessels escorting that that HVU, high-value unit, to the uninitiated that's moving through an area. And how is this different? One of the things that you mentioned was that the USVs that you were testing in the past, they only operated together in the sense that they vaguely knew where each other were. And during this test, you had five autonomous USVs, eight unmanned remote targets. How did those vessels interact? How did they add pieces to the puzzle? And how did those five autonomous vessels work together? Basically, how is this test? How did you push it to the next level?
Sure. So now the big difference is that now the boats know exactly where all the other boats are in that picture. They can either know that from like an AIS-like signal that's out there that we can sit there, which is a little bit vague as far as precise location. But each one of the boats has this Caracas, which is the control architecture for robotic agent command and sensing. Okay. So Caracas is what the NASA JPL guys came up with years ago to go on the Mars rover. That's where this ring really started, is they needed something. It takes 7 minutes for a signal to go to Mars and 7 minutes for that electron to get back. So if you're going to drive remote control, very difficult to do, because by the time you get to the crater, you know, you realize you're at the crater. You've already sent the signal that says turn, you know, go straight. It's going. And by the time it gets there, it's too late. Things already tumbled down the crater. So they came up with this architecture to be able to look at and go, all right, how do I have the robot, the Mars rovers, do this by themselves? So that navigation piece was part of this. And so now precise location information, each one of the boats has this Caracas system on board. They know with GPS, they can tell exactly where they're at. They also know what they are relative to each other because they had radar. So they had a radar system, and they can figure out with their, based on their contacts that, hey, I've got a contact that's, you know, 330 at, you know, 300 yards. Well, guess what? I've got an a Caracas system that's 330 at 300 yards. Guess what? I'm going to fuse those two contacts together, and that is the yellow boat or the orange boat or whatever colors we had. So all of the autonomous boats knew where each other was, and especially where they were relative to the high value asset, the blue boat that was in the middle. And then similarly, what we did is we had radar that would tell us where those remote control HSMSTs, the eight of them you mentioned, we knew where those were. Based on, they had a reporting system. They have their own Blue Force tracker, for lack of a better term. And we took that information in and we put that into our common operating picture. So what we always try to do with the boats is we're trying to make these just like you would do with a coxswain. And you'd tell the coxswain, hey, take up position 330 at 300 yards. And that's all you're trying to do. And they use their own eyes and their own ears and their own ability to steer and keep themselves in position. And if they see something out in front of them, they slow down and they try to avoid it. And they talk to each other. In this instance, they talk to each other electronically and make each other aware of where they're at. So really what we're doing is we're trying to replace the human with this and have the system know where it's at, know where everybody else is at to build that situational awareness picture, and then act accordingly based on intruders, based on what the high value asset does, you know, turns, whatever it happens to be, to do that station keeping thing. So very much human involved, and all the testing that we have done has been with a human coxswain aboard, and we do rules of the road testing and things like that. And when we're done, we go, hey, coxswain, what would you have done? And I'd say 90% of the time, at least, those guys say that's exactly what I have done, would have done. And if they don't say that, then we go back and we tweak the code to make sure that they do say that.
Now, you mentioned that they talk to each other in order to find each other's location. Is there anything data-wise? So, you know, we have data links in the Navy where one platform can tell another platform its own fire control solutions. Is there any way that these USVs communicate contact information or intentions to one another? And if not, is that something intended for the future?
No, they do. They are constantly. So each vessel has its own sensor package, and it's computing, so it's got a video, an EO system maybe, or an IR system. And a lot of times what we have for those are stereo EO or stereo IR, so it can do ranging, not only bearing but range with that EO system. We also have radar. So it's going to get a bearing and range off the radar. Well, there's a fusion engine on board each one of the boats that takes that bearing and range from IR or EO and that bearing and range from the radar. And it goes, well, those are relatively close. You know what? Oh, that's what we're going to make that into one contact. And then all the boats, they have their own picture based on what they have for their own sensors. And then they talk to each other and they share that picture amongst each other. So even though one boat doesn't have a radar, maybe it might have no sensors whatsoever. If it's under the sensor coverage of some other boat or a sensor that we're feeding into the system of another boat, it can be read right into it. It'll know what's around it, even though it has no sensors. The other, you know, it's blind, but the other boats can tell it where to go. It can tell it, hey, here's what's around you. And they're constantly contacted. They're constantly talking to each other, updating that picture so that they're all operating on the same picture. Because that's a very important part of this. Because if they're all operating off of a different picture, imagine, you know, 11 folks on a football field on offense. And, you know, they see, instead of seeing 11 folks on defense, one sees 10, the other one sees, you know, 13, and I'm going to block the 13th guy, but the other one doesn't see the 13th guy because there isn't one there. So they all have to operate on that same exact picture. So that's part of it. It was, we synchronize that picture, and we do it at a very low bandwidth. It's sending contact reports. We're not sending all kinds of messages and data and things like that. It's very much a contact and then being a type, a heading, a speed, but very low data rate contact reporting amongst the boats, and they all share that information, and they fuse between boats. So there's the fusion engine also looks at that and says, well, one boat sees them at 330 at 30. The other boat sees them at, you know, relatively, it's maybe 350 at 30. Oh, you know what? That's close enough. I'm going to fuse those into one contact because I happen to have data that tells me that those are really close to being the same contact. And if they resolve themselves later on and become two contacts, no big deal because they were close enough for that purpose. But I mean, anybody that's worked on a ship and anybody that's been in a combat information center and looked at the, you know, contact report, you know, go back to the days of JOTS and all the other stuff, you see this big long trail and, hey, there's USS Theodore Roosevelt. Oh, there it is again. There it is again. There's a trail of 50 of them. Which one is it really? You know, that's, we had to avoid that. So we have a fusion engine that takes care of all that and make sure that we don't have that problem.
So what are some of the other unique technologies? Well, they don't have to be unique. They can be interesting because, for example, what you just mentioned, low bandwidth, it's maybe not high tech, but it's irregular from the way that we want to use everything high bandwidth all the time with as much data as possible. So what are some of the technologies in this project that you are impressed by or particularly intrigued by or that you've been surprised by?
Some of the things I think one of the biggest ones is, as we start looking at some of the electro-optical sensors and the infrared sensors, and we start doing things with stereo vision and the ability to passively range, you know, objects and things like that. Because if you think about it, again, I talk about a person being on the boat and we're trying to replicate that person. What's a coxswain do? If you're at the helm, what are you doing? You're looking out in front of you and you're trying to see what something's, and you're looking at it. You might look on radar. That gives you a cue and it tells you to look at a specific area. Hey, there it is. And to get your binoculars out, things like that. Some of the work that we're doing right there with those sensor systems is really, very, very intriguing. And I can't go into much about that because of classification issues and things. But that is the kind of things that we need to get to give ourselves the ability to operate in denied environments and, you know, in the fog. You know, right now, when you go in the fog, what happens? You slow down. What if I've got an IR sensor? Some of these shortwave IR sensors are pretty good at seeing through particulate and things like that. So how do I use that to augment? So trying to get as much of a sensor feedback as we can to the computer so that it understands where it's operating and what's around its environment is really, that's the really the cool stuff that goes into it. But then once you bring that environment in and you know, the software that we're using, because the hardware really isn't anything exciting, but the software that you're using does that, those first steps of AI. And we're starting to get into the artificial intelligence world. We're not there yet, but that's starting to take, we're making decisions based on the environment around us. So the code, the collision regulations work. You know, there's times when I've been out there and the folks that we work with say, hey, try to break the system. So I'll line up an impossible collision regulation scenario where we're overtaking and someone's coming from the other side and someone's coming behind us and all at the same time. And, you know, now it's really complicated and we try to make the system break and it doesn't. It does the right thing. And again, we turn to the coxswain afterward and go, what do you think? And he went, that's what I would have done. So that's really the interesting stuff is the ability of the system to take over and do that kind of stuff, and do those things and take that human out of the loop so that we can get, you know, I look at it. My biggest thing that astounds me is for the minesweeping mission. You know, we put folks on a boat and we drive through the middle of the minefield, and, you know, and someone winches their eyes and grabs the wheel, you know, really tight and hopes they don't hit anything. You know, boy, wouldn't it be great so we don't have to do that. You can just let the remote control boat, you know, they do a remote control right now, but now you need that bandwidth, like you said. How about I tell it what the search is? We import the search engine, we dump it right into there and say, here's your path to follow, go do it. And the boat just does it all by itself, and it reports back, hey, something was in my way. You know, I turned to miss this part. But this software has got the ability to do all that stuff. So I think that's really, that is a very strong piece of this. And once the AI part gets even better and starts really becoming part of this, you're going to have the ability of these boats to reason just like people do right now. And then you get into all the quandaries of, you know, what are the ethical pieces that go with that and others. We won't have to get into that, but that's all kind of stuff that's coming. Just like self-driving cars, that stuff's going to be here before we know it. And it's going to change the way we do business, and it's going to change the way our adversaries do business, because they're going to have to react to what we're doing. So it's exciting stuff. Very interesting. It's and definitely it's,
you know, it's interesting you bring up minesweeping. I'm struck as we talk about all these different minesweeping and mine detection packages and all the technology and drones. I was reading about the tanker war and the U.S. or the motor vessel Bridgeton. And I remember reading that book and be like, wait, why are we doing all this complicated stuff? Why don't I just take something unmanned, a huge unmanned styrofoam-filled tanker, and drive it through the field? Let's not nuke this out. Sorry, folks. Nuking it out, all nuclear officers are insanely in the weeds with every problem they ever encounter. At least that's the stereotype. So when I say nuke it out, that's what I mean. But I mean, back in Vietnam, they had the Harry L. Glucksman, and that was a test ship where they would put 9 guys. They didn't have automated like we do now, but they put 9 guys in a padded bridge and they just drove a ship through an air. But I digress. I'm particularly passionate about that topic. I think it's really neat. But I want to get back. So let me be a good interviewer here and bring us back onto the rails of the topic of discussion.
Sure.
And so you're talking about AI. You're talking about ways that the platforms can overcome problems. You mentioned 2 things in your discussion of the technology, 2 things that at least I imagine the system in part relies, and that's a certain amount of beacons and GPS. And, of course, we know that GPS has its own weaknesses and potential for spoofing, and that if an enemy ever learned of some sort of beacon system, it could learn how to home onto it. Are there any attempts to make a system that doesn't require these crutches? And in doing that, are we investigating the integration of more learning kind of softwares into these boats, so where it's not so much a programming language or the execution of a program, but the internal building of a program that learns as problem sets approach?
Sure. You're talking about a thing really called SLAM, simultaneous location or localization and mapping. Used in the UUV world right now. So the underwater guys use this a lot because they don't have access to GPS. Electronic nautical charts, we have those in the world map that we build, the world model that's in there. So we use electronic nautical charts. So we might see a buoy at a certain position, or we might see a land, you know, a point of interest on land that might be a spit of land or something like that. We're working on that issue right now where we can take that information and put that back in. If the GPS dies, it's not going to stop the boat, because the boat still knows it's, I would say it's not bumper boats. It's not going to drive around, you know, just bump up against the side of the river every time. But it's got a path that it's going to find, and it's going to go, without that GPS signal for a certain amount of time. Right now, some of the issues we have are safety, because how many unmanned surface vessels do we have driving around in the world? Not very many. And, much like what Google's running into with unmanned vehicles and cars, it makes people a little nervous driving around. And to be honest, we don't really unman them unless we've got a closed range, because we don't want to have anybody getting excited about this. And you're on your pleasure boat and, you know, 5 boats come flying right by you with nobody on them. So that would really upset the public, I think. So that's another part of what we're coming into, is that trust piece. So, yeah, we've got to get past that with the GPS piece. And we're working on that because we don't want that to be a problem. Same thing. You can go back to navigating the old way, just like we do. You look out the window and you see what's out there. So again, I go back to that part where I got the person on board. That's what I'm doing with the computer. So we want to be able to use that information. So that's another piece that we are working on to make sure you don't rely on that type of a system, because it also could be spoofed. And now it just shuts you down. So, you know, those are all places where you don't want to be vulnerable, because then it makes the system useless if it's vulnerable to either IA attacks or, you know, GPS spoofing, things like that.
And in regards to the learning software, have you pursued a path where these autonomous vehicles are able to develop their own, I don't want to call it their own plan of action, but to learn as time goes on?
They don't learn per se, but they do work on a plan of action. Okay. So they are able to adapt on the fly to changes in their environment. Just like you and I do. If there is a barrel in front of the boat, it will turn, even though it's supposed to go straight ahead to make its way to the waypoint. It's going to turn to avoid that barrel. There's a boat coming across its bow. It's going to turn and follow the collision regulations to go around that boat. And then it's going to continue back on its path. So it's a goal-oriented piece. The goal is to get to the next turn point or get to the Washington Naval Yard. I mean, right now we could take the boat, cut it free from where it's at down here in Norfolk, and tell it to go to the Washington Navy Yard. It knows how much fuel it has. It knows what the nautical charts tell it. It knows where the depth of the water is. It knows exactly how to get up there, and it knows the rules of the road. So we can cut it free. It can drive up next to the USS Barry up there at the Navy Yard and just sit there and take a picture of it and send it back without us talking to it at all. It can do that right now. Again, you know, is the public, is the Coast Guard, or is the Navy ready to send that boat up the river all by itself with nobody on it? No, certainly not. But we might do it with a chase boat in behind, or have a coxswain on board just to monitor. But those are all things that are in the realm of the possible right now. So yes, the software has that capability. It does constant replanning to get to its goal the whole time it's out there. And again, that goes back to what it's doing on Mars. It's constantly replanning. They're constantly talking to each other, and they're sharing that plan so that they can know, hey, here's what I've got to do, and that guy's doing that, so he's affecting my plan. So now I'm going to change my plan to make sure that I get to my goal. And then the other boat goes, yep, I'm going to get to my goal by doing, you know, this to alter my plan. So it is not path following. It is not, you know, breadcrumbs on the ground. It's not plugged in where you say, hey, here's the path, go do it. I'm going to script it all out for you. It's none of that stuff. And again, I tell it, go to USS Barry. It figures out how to get there all by itself. It knows everything it needs to know, just like a young coxswain would know on board, you know, any one of the cruisers or destroyers that are out
okay,
there today.
So very adaptable, but not necessarily to the point where it's changing its own programming or learning and remembering lessons from the weird problem sets that you throw at it.
There are some learning algorithms. We can't go into much more than that happened. But yeah, stuff is happening. Yes.
Say no more. So it's been a year since we've executed this test, probably roughly a year by the time this podcast comes out. What are some of the lessons you've learned? So you could be surprising successes, developments, things that you didn't think were important at the time, or even throw out there challenges and failures that you're looking to solve in the future.
Well, I think the number one thing is trust. And this was the first time that we've unmanned that many boats with nobody around. And at one point we had 38 boats up on the James River by the dead fleet, the ghost fleet up there. And that was manned and unmanned. Obviously we had our 13 unmanned boats with the HSMSTs and then our five USVs, but there were all the folks, the Coast Guard, the Riverine folks to help us out to close things down, the safety folks, you know, so make sure that the boats don't run away. All those things go into it, and that's that trust piece. You know, we started out with this. We were going to have the vessels, the USVs, stay at about, we wanted them to be about 50 yards off of the high value asset and take positions about 50 yards off each one of them. So we said, well, we'll start out at 100 yards and then we'll work our way in to 50 yards once everybody gets comfortable. Well, we started at 100 yards and we worked our way out to 150 yards because there was a lot of issues. I mean, folks were truly, the trust isn't there, and it wasn't there at the time. At the beginning, we were like, wow, people were going, hey, what's that guy doing? As soon as the boat started to turn and point its bow at the HVU, it's like, well, what's he doing? What's it doing? And then when you started getting them on, you know, used to that and see that, don't worry, the rudder's hard over, it's going the other direction, because the boats were going very slow. And, you know, some boats follow a little bit and you're at min steerage, or you might be up on plane, things like that. So, yeah, again, getting that trust factor in there, getting folks to understand how the vessel vessel operates. And then we're in close quarters. When you're operating the James River, it's not a very wide channel. I think at any given point, you might have 500 yards at some of the widest points there. So, you know, we're necking down and we're trying to get all these vessels through this little needle. So those are some of the pieces that are in there. I think, and I know that as we got further and further along and we started getting to the unmanning of the vessels, and we really started unmanning them, where we had five of them unmanned at any given time. And after we had been doing this for a couple, 3 days, the trust factor was gone way up. And then folks started realizing that, yeah, it's going to do what we said it was going to do. And the programming is right. And the boats react how they're supposed to react every time. So now let's let them go. One time we had a boat that had an engine just fail, you know, it just died. You know, sometimes the engines die. They're boats. You know, things happen. So the engine failed. And so that fails. And one of the fail safes is the boat just obviously goes dead in the water, but the system goes dead. It just says, hey, I'm in pause. So we got the boat to fire back up again because we could do that. So we fired the boat back up. And then it was just like, and it was way behind. But the Caracas system knows, hey, I'm supposed to be way up there because I fell way behind. So at first people are like, well, remote control, drive it up there. It's like, no, let's let Caracas get it back in position. So we let the robot do it. And sure enough, Caracas put it up at speed, put it up on plane, chased right back down and took position right where it was supposed to again. So that, you know, again, those are those trust issues that you come with it. And, you know, when something, when we did one of these when I was on active duty, we had an unmanned boat driving right at our manned boat, which was the target vessel. And the captain, one of the TV reporters from the local area was on the bridge, asked the captain, you know, what do you think about this whole thing? And the captain turned to him and he goes, it's unnerving. And that was all he said the whole time, but he was absolutely right. It's unnerving to see a boat with nobody on it heading right towards you. So from a good guy perspective, you're out there and you've got these boats all around your ship, and you got to get the trust to know that they're not going to hit you and they're going to do what you're supposed to do. But think about it from the bad guy perspective. So now you've got a swarm of these boats heading out towards them, and there's nobody on them. So you can't influence them to, I'm going to fire a shot at them, or I'm going to shoot a flare. The boat doesn't care. You know, it's a robot. Shoot all the flares you want. I'm coming right at you. So that's got to be unnerving to an adversary as well. So those are some of the things that we saw. That are really, I think those are the important lessons to learn. I equate it to the self-driving car piece. There are people right now that will be more than happy. The early adopters will jump in the self-driving car and have it take it wherever they want. And they'll be happy to do that. And then there's some other folks that are a little bit older, or maybe not quite as comfortable with the technology. There's no way they're ever going to give up the steering wheel and they're going to let the car drive them around. We're going to have the same issue with unmanned vessels on the water. We have that same issue with the UAVs already. We have our own airspace that we operate in, and we're just starting to integrate UAVs into the national airspace. So these are things we have to overcome and figure out how we're going to do the ethics piece of this, and also how we're going to get the public to be comfortable with that. And then how do we follow the rules of the road and everything else? So I think that's one of the biggest things we learned. One of the biggest surprises I think that we saw was how reliable the equipment had been for us. It would have been experimental. It had been doing a lot of different things. We really pushed it hard, and we thought that there might be some issues, and there were things that we had to deal with. But, you know, all in all, we were very happy with the amount of time that the vessels operated themselves and that they did the right thing, because we did an in-depth analysis after it was all said and done and looked at the number of times that a human operator had to interfere. For whatever reasons, because someone was afraid that it was getting too close, or one time there was a barge that was out there. A human driving a tugboat drove his barge full of gravel aground trying to cut the corner around a light. And he cut the corner all right, and he put his barge hard aground. So now that was really close to our operating area. So now our USVs had to drive by there. So there were times we had to take control because it was too close inside that bubble. Even though we knew the USV could do it, we still let the human take over just so we had that positive control. That's the kind of stuff that I think we're really working. It's how do you make sure, there's some folks from DARPA, Scott Littlefield up at DARPA. He's the guy that's running a program called Active for, basically a big unmanned boat. His point and his brief has always been, what is the level of trust and capability that you need from your robot? Is it the high nines? Does it have to be 99.999? Or is it the drunken Exxon Valdez skipper? Is that close enough? Or does it have to be somewhere in between? And what does society say is that right answer? So we've got to come to grips with those questions right now and figure out what those numbers are and the testing and the VNV. But You know, what are those answers? You tell me. I don't know. Someone else much smarter than I is going to have to come up with that answer.
Well, it's important to remember they do give us OOD letters before. We've only been 2 years in the Navy as junior officers. So when you say 10, there's a lot of us driving out there that probably don't reach the level of the robot here yet. and, you know, it's very heartening to hear how you describe how this your team gradually sort of gain the trust as they watch the system operate, because it's important to remember, you know, this is, you know, there's two sides to this coin. It's not just the opponent being unnerved, but these things are eventually going to be aimed at us as well. You know, we're not going to have a monopoly on this kind of technology. So the faster we embrace it, the better. Well, the faster we embrace it done right,
the better we're going to have. That's correct.
In that light, my final question would be then, reflecting on all that you've accomplished and the many tests, you know, we're talking about a force protection test here, but we both know that the future of autonomy so much more grand than the tests we have today. But what do you see as the potential? How do you see this technology specifically in the surface realm? Everyone talks about UUVs and UAVs. But you're exactly right at the beginning of this podcast. We don't talk about and we don't see USVs. Where do you see this technology going? What are we going to do with it? What it's going to look like in the next 10 to 15 to 30 years?
Well, you know, good question. All right. So I just was up at a CSBA meeting for that same question. You know, what is it going to look like in 2035, you know, and beyond? And, you know, I think one of the biggest things you're going to see is you're going to see not only the UAVs and the UUVs out there and have these USVs, but what you've got to have is they've all got to talk to each other. They've got to share their own sensors amongst themselves. And then they got to take this situation where, say you're the captain of your destroyer or your LCS, okay? So now you're on an LCS and you got a couple of 7-meter ribs or 11-meter ribs that you've got this system, because it's very small. We can put this in a case and throw it on board. And that's what we did for this experiment or demonstration. Now you have that and you can drive it manually, or, hey, this is really dangerous. I don't want to drive it manually. I want to let it go out there. You can expand your battle space. And in full disclosure, you talked about nukes earlier. I was a nuclear engineer and that scared me to death. So that's why I went aviation. But, you know, to me, I look at things from the atomic perspective. I use the atomic model, and the nucleus is the ship itself. And then the electrons are those USVs and UAVs and UUVs that are encircling the nucleus of the boat. And they're encircling and they're expanding the captain's battle space. So now, instead of having just his own sensors aboard, now the captain, he or she's going to be able to have all these other sensors that are truly going to expand the battle space, you know, immensely. And so now you're going to be able to reach out way further out, and you're going to be able to see what's happening, and you can deter intent or infer intent. One of my favorite ones I talk about is the coal. If we had USVs like this when the coal was in Yemen, okay, now it's just patrolling around in a little circle around the outside, okay, of coal. Someone's coming in. It automatically intercepts. It queries. You can have a sailor pick up a microphone and go, hey, what are you doing? And the guy goes, I'm bringing the garbage. Okay, you know, show me the paper. You get a camera that shows them whatever it happens to be. But if the guy doesn't respond, we can have program in there to nudge. We can shoulder that vessel out of the way. And then if he disregards it, you get an ROE breach, because now he didn't regard what you said. So now you can engage much further out. You don't let anybody get in close. So these are the kind of things, you know, look at that from a straight transit perspective or things like that. Now the captain has the ability to really influence his environment from far, far away, much greater distances than he had before. And now you're not putting people in harm's way. You're putting robots in harm's way. Big deal. You know, it cost me a 7-meter rib, but I found out that it didn't cost me my ship, you know, or it cost me a Scan Eagle or something like that. But, you know, I can get another one of those and I can launch it, and it's not going to be that expensive. So those are the kind of things I really think you're going to see. You're going to see them cooperating. You're going to see, you know, for instance, a USV has a very good shot at getting a very detailed and precise location information. So now it's working in conjunction with a UUV that's out there maybe doing mine warfare, and it's looking for mines underwater. I mean, the big issue with a UUV, hey, it can't find out where it's at. So it has to surface every once in a while and figure out where it's at. It could burst its data right to the USV. The USV can say, here's where you're at. Exactly. Thanks. Give me your data. Go back down again. I'll send your data back to the mothership and we'll be happy. And now you've got that partnership going with those two, and now you can start having those really go out further. So there's a lot of opportunities. I mean, we're not even scratching the surface. One of the things that I saw when I ran the experimentation program was the best thing that you could ever do was give these technologies to the sailors out there, give them to them and just go, here you go, play with it. You guys tell me what you want, because the engineers have their own ideas and those are all great, but they're not operators. Give them to the operators. Let the operators play with it. Let them figure out what they really want to do with it. And they're going to find some really cool things to do. And they're going to push the envelope and we're going to go, hey, we need to fix that, or we really need to add something else. And that's what you're going to see. And that's what you're going to see, the evolution of this happening. And you're going to see people really, I think you're going to see grabbing on, you know, what was it, 30 years ago when GM went bankrupt the first time. You know, they were like, well, it costs a lot of money to pay someone $25 an hour to put a screw in a dashboard and pay healthcare and you know, retirement. And then they went bankrupt again. You know, and now you hear all the talk in the Navy and the DOD about our personnel costs too much money. You know, we got to do something about that. This is part of that answer. And then the scary part is that whenever you mention this to anybody, it's like, well, you're going to take my people away. And so that's another piece we've got to get over. Is, yeah, it's going to be reduced manning, but is it going to be reduced manning to the LCS level? Is it going to be more capabilities because I can see 300 miles out now and I don't have to have as many people to do that job? You know, those are all things that come into play. So lots of doctrinal things to, you know, to grab, lots of con ops to grab, and then lots of experimentation and with the actual operators. And it's really going to be fun. I look forward to it. I look forward to getting into my self-driving car someday very soon and having it drive me someplace. And the same thing, I'd love to have a boat to do the exact same thing so that I don't have to sit there and I can drink a beer on the back and not worry about the Marine police getting in, getting on me or anything like that. So great opportunities here. It's cool stuff. And the government is the one that they did, you know, NASA spent a lot of time getting this ready for flight. This is something that's out there, and I think it's really got a lot of promise, and I look forward to seeing it happen in the real world.
And who knows? If we're lucky, maybe the defense budget will stop taking a beating. Instead of filling gaps, we'll just have a lot of extra capability, and I can still do maintenance.
that would, and you know what? You bring up an excellent point, because that's what you need. You know, what do you need with an unmanned boat? You need someone still to put oil in it and put fuel in it. And so we get the robots that can do all that for you, then, you know, you're going to get to that
point.
Well,
that's when Skynet does finally kill us all, because it doesn't need us anymore.
That's right. It'll get to that point, but then it'll turn into, what was the movie with the robots
Wall-E.
It was a big trash. Yeah, Wall-E, Wall-E. Right? We're all driving around in, you know, chairs, and we're all drinking big gulps.
I like to think that if Skynet ever does appear, it's pretty much going to live in the internet. Since the internet consists of, what, 90% animated GIFs of cats, it probably won't be that evil. I mean, it'll be slightly deviant. I mean, let's be serious. There's a lot of messed up stuff on the internet, but the amount of random cute animal pictures will probably push it into the good side. But, sir, it has been an absolute pleasure having you on the podcast, and I look forward to seeing you in 2 weeks at the SNA event.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks a lot. It was great talking to you as well, and hope everything goes all right for you today, and then I will see you in 2 weeks.